With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the 66 to 87 podcast. It's the first edition of August, which means we're only about a month away from training camp getting started and all the fun begins again, which is awesome. This is Tom Reed, your host and moderator, joined by, as always, by Taylor Haas and Dave Molinari. We will be joined a little bit later. Oh my God, there's a plane flying right overhead. Well, he doesn't have a garbage truck behind him, so that's good. Joined a little bit later by the NHL Network's Jody Shelley, who also does a lot of the games for the Columbus Blue Jackets. Always insightful, good to talk to. He'll be on a little bit later. But this is being recorded on a Monday, and Brock McGinn, one of the newest Pittsburgh Penguins, met with the media on Zoom calls today. Dave, you were on that entire call. What did he have to say in his first real meeting with the Penguin media?
Well, nothing terribly inflammatory or insightful. He says that he part of the reason that he signed here is that he believes the Penguins are capable of winning a Stanley Cup. I think, you know, that certainly is open to debate. I said he believes that he's capable of producing more offense than he did when he was in Carolina, although, you know, that's not why the Penguins brought him in. But he did have a season last year where over an 82-game schedule would have projected to 82 goals, or excuse me, to 18 goals over 82 games. 82 goals, yeah, they probably, he might even rise above the bottom six if he could score 82. But no, so, you know, there was nothing that particularly stood out from the discussion, but, you know, he does seem like he's excited for the season ahead and looking forward to being here.
Look, we don't have to tell any of our listeners and know what Brandon Tanev meant to this lineup the last couple years and how well he played in it, the energy he brought, the tenacity, some great clips. I'd love to have him mic'd up every game. But I'll say this, for me, I've watched a lot of Carolina. I've liked that team in years past. And I think McGinn's a pretty good player. I think he's a little bit different, but I think he'll be a nice fit. Taylor, you did one of your drive to the net segments on him. Give me your initial impressions of him, what you saw of him in Carolina, and how he might fit here.
Yeah. So, I mean, something he did talk about on Monday is how he's looking to, you know, up his offensive game, and he kind of was able to show a little bit more of that in Carolina last season. But if you look at like the breakdown of his points last season, so I mean, he had the 8 goals and 5 assists in 37 games. He was hurt at the end of the season, so he didn't play the full season. But nearly all of that production, 7 goals and 4 assists, came in the first 16 games of the season, when he was mostly playing on the top line with Svechnikov and Aho. And then by late February, I mean, he was bumped down to the third line when the Hurricanes got healthier. And in that last 21 games of the regular season, he only scored 1 goal and 1 assist. So once he wasn't playing, you know, with those top guys, he really wasn't scoring at all. So it'll be interesting to see what he's able to produce, because I mean, he's not going to be a top line player here, you have to figure. So it'll be interesting to see just where his offense is at if he does stick on the bottom six. But I mean, as far as the defensive responsibilities, he was strong. I have the chart in that story, you know, I like using the J Fresh Hockey, where it kind of breaks down in percentile. Then he was in the 75th percentile for even strength defense, 83rd for PK, and that's kind of what you want for a guy like that. And he was matched up against good competition too. His most frequent forward opponents last season, the first four, it was Patrick Kane and DeBrincat with Chicago, and then Point and Palat with Tampa Bay. So, I mean, he was up out there against, you know, like good competition. But yeah, I mean, that offense, that's kind of what I'm most interested to see from him.
Dave, your impressions of him?
I think he's a good third line caliber player, you know, good defensively. People who watched him on a regular basis in Carolina say that he was able to generate and be involved in a lot more scoring chances than he was able to capitalize on. I don't know if that's the good news or the bad news for the Penguins. He probably will have some pretty decent line mates here if he's on the third line, as we would expect. You know, when they're healthy, he would have Jeff Carter as his center, which he could certainly do a lot worse. So I don't know that he'll necessarily be in a position to absolutely maximize his offensive potential, you know, have one of those 82-goal seasons we mentioned earlier. But, you know, he should have a chance to put up some decent numbers while, you know, playing well in his own end.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. If you're playing with Jeff Carter, just go to the net, because the puck's probably going to end up there at some point, the way he shoots and is usually gets it on net. So we'll see what happens.
Hey, another thing from that you know, stats piece I did, of among Hurricanes forwards, McGinn was the best at creating off of high danger passing plays, which is from behind the net or through the slot. So if he's kind of in that area, relative to the rest of the Hurricanes forwards, he produced the best off of, you know, those kinds of shots. So if he does, you know, that might mesh well with Carter.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right, let's move on. Zach Aston-Reese was one of 17 players around the league to elect to go to salary arbitration, as announced by the NHLPA. No formal date yet for his arbitration, should it get to that point. But somewhere in the period of August 11th to the 26th, if they do get to that point. Dave, this is one of those things. Arbitrations can be tricky, and they can get personal. Even though you like the player, basically your side is supposed to come in and tell them why this player is not worth the money he's asking for. And sometimes these can get a little bit nasty. I think a lot of teams try to avoid them. We've seen in the past a lot of times at the 11th hour, a deal is reached. Your thoughts on what lies ahead here with Czar?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, because we don't know what positions the two sides have staked out to this point in the negotiations. We don't know how far apart they are, and you know, there's no risk for Aston-Reese in filing for arbitration, because if he reaches an agreement with the Penguins beforehand, you know, you simply cancel the arbitration hearing and life goes on. So, you know, I certainly don't think that, unless there's a much greater gap than we suspect, you know, between the two negotiating positions, I don't know that there's anything to be particularly worked up about at this point.
Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would benefit both sides to get something done before arbitration. And that's what happened in 2019 when he did file for arbitration, but they agreed to a two-year contract, $1 million cap hit. It was literally like the day of his hearing was supposed to happen. And that, so Aston-Reese, if this does go to arbitration and, you know, the ruling is his contract, he's only entitled to a one-year deal. If that's how this is settled, because he turns 27 later this month, it's last year of restricted free agency. Yeah, you have to think he'd want more than 1 year. But either way, if this does go to arbitration, the Penguins are locked into whatever is decided, because the only way If a player elects arbitration, that a team can walk away from it and send a player to unrestricted free agencies if the settlement is above, it looks like just over $4.5 million. He's not going to get that. So, you know, if this goes to arbitration, the ruling is going to be binding. They have to stick with it. So, I mean, yeah, I think this is just kind of more negotiating power for Aston Reese. It just creates pressure to get a deal done sooner. I mean, I you'd have to think they're going to work something out before it gets to that. But we'll see. Back to the chart, you know, the percentiles and all that I mentioned for McGinn, the even strength defense, Aston Reese's percentile for the last two seasons was 100%. He was number one at, you know, preventing scoring chances for the last 2 years. So, I mean, that kind of stuff, you're not, there's like limits to what you can and can't bring up, in these kind of hearings. So, I mean, stuff like this, I don't think they're allowed to. You're allowed to talk about his defensive game and stuff like that, and maybe that should help his case. But I mean, as far as these like, niche advanced stats, I don't think those are allowed to be brought up, but, I mean, he definitely has, you know, stuff on his side that he can argue for.
Dave, I like this player. I've since coming over to the staff, I'd watched him before, but watching him almost every game this year, I like kind of what he brings. He's probably a bottom six guy. I know at times you've lobbied to maybe even try to throw him on the power play with a little bit of a net presence. If you're the Penguins and you end up kind of getting a deal done, would you be in favor of a couple years term with Czar?
Yeah, I don't think he's anywhere near the end of his career at this right. point. You know, we're not talking about a guy in, you know, Jeff Carter's demographic. yeah, you know, 3 or 4 years. Yeah, I'd be willing to make that kind of commitment to him. And, you know, I suspect Aston Reese would certainly go for that as well. It might actually lower the cap hit that he would take. And you know, if he would then go on to have one of those 82-goal seasons, you know, he'd really be a bargain for you. So
it's like it would be like the 85 Oilers all over again, Dave. Taylor, your final thoughts on him. If you're the Penguins, you want to lock him up for a couple years?
Yeah, if 3-ish years would be reasonable. That, so the website, it's called Evolving Hockey. It's like another advanced stats site. They do these kind of projections for free agents based on, you know, comparable players. And they're usually pretty dead on, pretty accurate. And they have him worth $2.1 million. So yeah. You're probably looking at something around that range. And I don't think that's that that unreasonable. Maybe if you could, you know, give him a little bit more term, you could lower that cap hit. But yeah, I mean, he's me low cost signing either way. So three-four years, that would be reasonable, I think.
That's the site run by a couple of brothers, right? Is that the one?
I'm not sure. There's so many of them.
Yeah, for some reason, I think I met them in Columbus. And if I get this wrong, I apologize already on the air, but yes, that's a good site. That is a very good site.
They have the Teddy Bluger contract dead on, like exactly, yeah, like the 100,000.
Yeah. So it's for fans that want to start to get a little bit more analytically minded, and let's be honest, that's the way the game is going. Evolving Wild is a very good site. And let's move on here. I don't think anyone would have had on their bingo card. Playoff bingo card. What if Casey DeSmith hadn't got hurt? But here we are. Every segment here during the offseason, we kind of take one player and kind of evaluate his season. And Casey DeSmith's probably comes down to what had Casey DeSmith not gotten hurt right before the playoffs started? And as Tristan Jarry starts to melt down a little bit, would the Penguins have maybe gone with him in a must-win game six? Just looking at his stats over his career, pretty steady as a backup. You look at his save percentage, it's always stayed above 910, 921, 916, 912 last year, 2.54 goals against average in 20 games. I thought he was actually the better goaltender early in the season. Not that anyone was lighting the world on fire for the Penguins in the first 20 games. I thought he was decent. Again, I don't project him to be a starter. But I thought, Dave, if you were sitting in Mike Sullivan's position going into game six and you had a healthy Casey DeSmith, would you have played him?
No.
You would have stuck with Tristan Jarry.
Absolutely. Jarry did not have a bad game five. Jarry had a horrific, ghastly, unforgivable mistake that ended right. game five, but he didn't have a poor overall performance in that game. You know, he's your number one guy. You know, unless you had reason to believe that he was going to implode the way he did in game six, I absolutely would not have changed goalies. I think that would have come across to everyone, including the guys in the locker room, as a panic move. So, no, right. I absolutely would not have started DeSmith. Now, you know, I would have not necessarily waited too terribly long into game six before inserting him when I saw the way the game was going, but I definitely would not have started him.
Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, we had this conversation before of, you know, if he were healthy, would we have even seen him? And I'm kind of on the same page as Dave, where I don't think we would have seen him before game five. And then Jarry's game five, like, the rest of the game, he had a good game five. It was just, you know, the turnover in overtime. But I don't think that would have been enough to, you know, change goalies going into game six. I think we would have seen DeSmith at some point in game six, but maybe, I mean, by then, the way that game was going, I think it would have been too late anyway. I mean, it's hard to say. I don't think we would have seen him if he were healthy other than in game six. And even then it wouldn't have made a difference.
You maybe not have put him in. I'm trying to get back game four when it started to get a little bit away from them in the third period, just to give him some minutes, or no, you just ride that out.
Go ahead
and answer that.
If the game was that out of hand, maybe to get him some playing time in case he does end up getting needed later. But then again, it's not something that would have made much of a difference, I think.
Yeah.
No, and, you know, you certainly would have gone back to Jarry in game
sure.
five anyway.
Game
so,
five.
You know, the scenario would have been pretty much the same as it was, you know, as it actually played out in reality. So,
yeah, it looks to be, and we're going to get into this a little bit more in our next segment, but right now, and a lot can change, it looks there's a good chance that they just run it back with the same two goalies they had last year. What is your level of confidence in DeSmith, Dave, as a the backup goalie here?
I think he's absolutely fine as a backup. I think that's been established that if you are just looking for a guy to be a traditional backup goalie to, you know, start 20, 25 games, you know, something in that neighborhood, that he'll do a perfectly adequate or better job than that. You know, if you think you need somebody to either mentor Jarry or press him for playing time, you know, maybe you look elsewhere. But if you just want a guy to be a backup, I have absolutely no issue with Casey DeSmith handling that job.
Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, he's a fine backup. He's not a 1B, you know, to go along with a 1A. He's not going to, like Dave said, he's not going to press Jarry to necessarily be better because he's not going to take over the starting job, at least for, you know, permanently. So, I mean, I think if they do upgrade the goaltending in any way, I mentioned it, like, I don't think it would have been moving out Jarry for a different number one. I think keep Jarry, get a different 1B to play along with him and be that insurance and be that kind of, you know, someone can push him, and DeSmith just isn't that.
Craig Button, we had Craig Button on last week, and Button's thought, and we've heard this before, is if you're going to keep Jari, nothing against Casey DeSmith, maybe you want to bring in a veteran goalie who's been in the wars, can help him, mentor him through the up and down times, even in the playoffs, even if you're not, the goalie's not playing. And Dave, I thought you had an interesting story the other day. I can't foresee Henrik Lundqvist being in Penguin colors next year, but I did think it was kind of an out of the box thought by you. If you know, obviously Henrik Lundqvist last year did not play. There were some concerns about his health with his heart. We'll see where he is, whether he decides he wants to come back for another season. But I did think it was an interesting out of the box thought of, here's a guy who's played in a Stanley Cup final, has been a Vezina Trophy winner, has been a finalist other times. Just your thoughts on that story, why you wrote it, and kind of how possible is something like that? And if, would you, let's put it this way, if you're the Penguins, would you kick the tires there? Would you ask him, hey, where, what are you thinking? And would you at least be thoughtful of this?
Well, that would really depend on what I felt that I had seen from him, you know, while scouting him 2 seasons ago in his last year in New York. You know, first of all, he's made it pretty clear that he wants to continue playing, but he does not have the medical clearances that he needs yet to resume playing. So, you know, the whole issue might be moot. I think it's highly unlikely at best that he would end up with the Penguins, but you know, if they would decide that they wanted to bring in an experienced guy, one who seems highly motivated, doesn't mean he's still highly capable, but seems highly motivated to take one last run at winning a Stanley Cup, you know, maybe that's something they could look at. But I really don't expect it to happen.
Right. All right. Well, we'll move on. We're going to the roundtable segment next. Stick with us here on the 66 to 87 podcast. Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast here on the DK Pittsburgh Sports Podcasting Network. Our leader, Dejan Kovacevic, as always, writes several columns a week, and DK never holds back. He's certainly somebody who is very passionate no matter what he's writing about. And I'm sure that the headline of today's column probably caught a lot of Penguins fans and maybe some people in the organization, certainly caught their attention. His headline today was, seriously, what in the heck are the Penguins doing this summer? And my guess is there's probably a few Penguin fans that are probably asking the same questions. We always mention here, we've been mentioning this since really the start of free agency and even right before that in the expansion draft, there's still time. But as I mentioned at the start of this, we're now in August. So we got about 5 or 6 weeks here before training camp. And DK's tone here is simply, man, there's been a lot of, there's been some departures here. When we talk about Tanev being gone, we talk about Freddie Gaudreau being gone. There's been so much talk about, can they go back into the season with Tristan Jarry and Casey DeSmith? Could they have made some kind of effort to get Marc-Andre Fleury? How did Cody Ceci get away? And there's just, I've said, again, I think there's probably the people out there in the fan base, they're kind of wondering what is going on. Why aren't the Penguins being a little bit more proactive? So Taylor, I'll start with you. Talk us off the ledge here a little bit about what's going on. And are these legitimate concerns? And when you take them, not in one by one, but in totality, seems like a lot to do here between now and the start of the season.
Yeah, I mean, the team last year, they did win the division, and they would have made it out of, you know, the first round, maybe further, if they had, you know, decent goaltending. Jarry can still be that guy for them. They, the way he ended the playoffs last year, that doesn't mean that they necessarily have to go out and get a goaltender I mean, every time I bring back Fleury, Fleury had, you know, playoff struggles of his own early in his career, and now people are looking at him as the answer because people can grow out of it. But as far as, like, you know, looking at every one of these individual moves Hextall did and, you know, getting all worked up about him, that just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, Fleury was never going to come back here. Back when he was with Vegas, I mean, the reason Vegas was looking to unload him is because they wanted to dump his $7 million salary. You know, people look at, oh, the Blackhawks got Fleury for nothing. That means the Penguins could have gotten Fleury for nothing. No, because the Penguins could have taken on that $7 million. Vegas was not looking to retain any of it. And if you want to get, you know, a third team involved and, you know, make it really complicated, rebuilding teams are the ones that, you know, they're those third teams. They want picks and prospects. The Penguins don't have those to give up. And then, I mean, once Fleury was in Chicago, that's not an option either because, now he wants to play there. He's going to Chicago. They're not going to flip that goal. They're not going to flip him now that he wants to play there. So Fleury was never an option. And then the Cody Ceci thing, everyone's obsessed with this idea that Cody Ceci was allowed to walk. Like, he's a free agent. He can do what he wants. He has no reason to really be loyal to Pittsburgh. He was here for, what, 6 months out of his life total. He got 4 years for 3.25 with Edmonton. Who's to say that even if the Penguins did offer that he would have taken it here? I mean, I tweeted this Sunday night. 3-4 years from now, which team is going to be in a better position? The Oilers probably will still have Draisaitl and McDavid. They're not without their flaws, but I think it's a whole lot easier to fix where they are than to, you know, get a new core, make the Penguins core younger. So I think the idea that the Penguins, you know, just didn't want to scrounge together the money for Cody Ceci, he might not have taken it anyway. So looking at all these individual moves in isolation, it's just silly, I think.
Dave, I want to start with you on a topic that you broached in our last 66 to 87 podcast. So that means fans have to go back and listen. But for those who don't want to, Dave's point was to Cody Ceci's situation, maybe part of the thinking of the organization is we just locked up John Marino, a guy that we really liked. Now, again, that was the previous administration did the locking up. But maybe part of the thinking is we can save that money for something else and just bump John Marino up in the pairings. That they like the kid. They think he's going to be a pretty good defenseman. Do you think that could have played into their thinking here? And again, I know you were giving your opinion the last time, but do you think that at least thought that crossed their mind as they were weighing whether to give a little money to CeCe?
Well, it certainly could have. I mean, I don't know whether it did or not. You know, Ron Hextall has not been sharing many of his private thoughts with people outside the organization. I certainly think that Marino, based especially on what he showed us during his rookie season, is certainly capable of being a good second pairing defenseman and an effective partner for Mike Matheson. Not that my opinion particularly matters, but, you know, in general, you know, I think people shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, you know, the regular season opener is October 12th. And if the Penguins roster on October 11th looks like it does today, then there is real cause for concern. But there's an awful lot that can change between now and then. And just because, you know, they didn't make epic moves in the first couple days of free agency doesn't mean that, you know, that the roster, you know, when they go to Tampa is, you know, going to be the same as it is today. I think, you know, people obviously, you know, like seeing activity in free agency and they enjoy trades and player movement and whatever. But, you know, you really don't have to have your team intact in mid to late summer. So, you know, I think people would be would be well advised, if only for the sake of their blood pressure, to be a little more patient. Although I understand that most people think that patience is okay as long as you do it in a hurry.
and to expound on that point, I guess beyond even the opener, you do have it's going to be an 82-game schedule. It's not going to be the sprint in 56 games that it was last year. So during the course of this season, right up to the trade deadline, they can make moves. And again, I think we've talked about this before. This is such a volatile market right now, with moves being made and players coming available that you'd not think were going to be available back in June. There probably is time over the course of the year that they can make moves if they feel that they have to.
Well, so, at the moment, I believe there are seven teams that are above the salary cap.
Right.
Which is, legal. You're allowed to be 10% over the cap during the offseason. But those teams, obviously are going to have to make some moves.
Right.
And when one move is made, it often, triggers a series of moves around the league. There can be a domino effect. So, I really think people should, perhaps focus on the Steelers training camp or the Pirates playoff drive, and not focus too much on the Penguins roster just yet.
Hey, we can get back to fail for Kumar, because Rocker's going to be back in the draft. So maybe the Pirates end up getting Kumar Rocker after all. Go ahead, Taylor.
There are seven teams above. There are also three teams below the floor. The Red Wings are $4.5 million, so they need to spend at least $4.5 million. The Sabres are about $7.5 million, and the Senators about $8.5 million. There's definitely going to be moves to be made. I mean, the Penguins, as far as free agency, to stay cap compliant, they really don't have any room to do much at all. So, it would have to be a trade, something like moving Marcus Pettersson to free up cap space and, having PO take its spot. That can still happen. It's August. They have $2.5 million in space right now. And then that doesn't count Aston Reese, who's probably going to get somewhere around $2 million, you can figure. So yeah, that doesn't leave enough room to do anything else. The Horner does need to be re-signed too, but he doesn't need waivers. So if there isn't room for him, he can start in Wilkes-Barre. That's fine. And that $2.5 million figure, is assuming that Dominic Simmons starts in Wilkes-Barre, which, I agree with. I know, like, when people are talking about how though the Penguins should have done this X, Y, and Z with the money they had, but they went out and signed up like these fringe forwards. They include like Rodriguez, so I think you need Evan Rodriguez, that kind of depth. And Dominic Simmons, who I don't think is going to start up in Pittsburgh anyway. And if that's the case, then he's not going to count. I mean, when he was here before and when he was on the top line and on the top line in 2018-19, I was writing a lot about, why he's in the lineup and really what he brings to that top line. And even I don't think that he's going to start in Pittsburgh. So these people that are still blaming Dominic Simmons and his league minimum.
I hope that I do hope that the Pettersson family doesn't listen to our podcast, because I think every third show we're trying to trade him somewhere.
And of course, makes no sense.
I know.
I've seen people ask why PO can't replace CC, because PO doesn't play on the right side. And so the only kind of options in house for the right side under contract are Ruedel and Mark Friedman. In both of them, they filled in occasionally.
And the other thing, of course, is the one of the other elephants in the room, as far as the league is concerned, is we'll see where Jack Eichel ends up. Because if some team ends up taking Jack Eichel, they may end up having to move players themselves to accommodate it. So, again, there's a lot of time here.
I thought you were going to say Jack Johnson.
No. Just Jack Eichel. Jack Eichel will see in his bionic neck. Hopefully that works out for the kid, because didn't Gary Roberts have neck issues in his career?
When he was in Calgary.
Serious. That is, whatever team trades for him, they better have some kind of thoughts, assurances that he's going to be able to play at some point here soon. All right, let's move on over the weekend. Evgeny Malkin turned 35. Obviously, his next stop, we think, after Pittsburgh is going to be the Hall of Fame. I was going to say Toronto, but I don't want to get the Maple Leaf fans worked up, but going to be in the Hall of Fame. 35-year-old coming off knee surgery. Guys, let's talk a little bit about what should we expect when this guy comes back next season, depending on when he comes back. Dave, what is a realistic thought for him, expectation for him coming back next season?
I mean, I honestly can't even give you an educated guess because we have no idea when he's going to come back or, you know, really what the nature of his injury was. You know, if it's something, you know, that would, you know, not cause him to miss much of the regular season and would not cause any, would not be a serious impediment to him playing, I think, you know, you still can count on him for, you know, a good point a game, probably a bit more than that. I think he can still be a highly effective player, but, you know, there's a lot of wear and tear on him. And if that's a truly significant injury, obviously when they operate, there's some degree of severity there, but, you know, you can see how having knee surgery when you're 34 or 35 could be a serious impediment to you.
Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, no idea what his surgery is or what kind of timeline. I mean, the last kind of timeline we got was that once he gets to training camp, they're going to have, you know, a better idea of when to expect him to be back. So I know it's like I get in my live queues, it's like every week it's like, well, Malkin's probably going to be out 2 months. And it's like every week it's like, well, maybe he's going to be out 5 months. And like it's like fans keep, you know, extending the timeline. They're like, maybe they should put him on a long-term IR like they did with Kucherov. And it's like he might not be out that long. So it's hard to, you know, say what to expect from this season because no one has any idea when he's going to be back or, you know, how – you know, tough this surgery will be on him, but his age, I don't know, he had one of his, you know, best offensive years, you know, production 5-on-5, is that last year? So I mean, he wasn't slowing down necessarily before this, and then I mean towards the end of the season, yes, he also then, you know, wasn't 100% healthy when he came back, so it's hard to say what to expect.
Yeah, no, it's certainly understandable. All right, when we come back to the 66 to 87 podcast, Jody Shelley from the NHL Network and the analyst for the Columbus Blue Jackets will join us. We'll talk a little bit about toughness and truculence, and certainly he could bring that during his career, and also some of his thoughts on the Penguins and some other league matters. So stay with us. Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast. And as promised, we are being joined by NHL Network analyst, Columbus Blue Jacket analyst, and longtime NHL player, Jody Shelley. Jody, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Nice to catch up with you guys.
Yeah. And fans will probably remember during the playoffs, Jody made his national debut, first game nationally with NBCSN, correct, Jody? Or was
That's
it?
Right.
Yeah. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, that was fun. You know, you wonder what's going to happen. And with all the changes that were going to happen in the NHL, that landscape, I got to get in there and it was fun. We actually did a remote game from NBC, the big NBC studio up there in Connecticut. And we did it from like a little tiny booth, but it was fun to have three games going on at once and see those guys and interact with Kenny and Boosh and those guys that I know so well.
Yeah. Well, good stuff. I wanted to have you on at some point in this off season in one way, just because to kind of go back over a conversation you and I had during the regular season, and you kind of just brought this up unprompted. And you said, you know, there's been so much focus in the last 10 years on speed and skill. You wonder if you're going to start to see a a little bit of a correction with, it's never going to go back to real toughness and grit wins the day and dump the puck and whatever. But you were thinking, you were kind of hinting, it would not surprise you to see the league maybe start to go back that way. And lo and behold, the Islanders make a second run to the conference final. The Canadiens, with those huge defensemen, make it to the final. And we've seen Tampa Bay the last couple years, after getting swept by the Blue Jackets, adding that kind of grit that they lacked in previous seasons. So do you see that this may be continuing as we go forward here the next year or two?
Well, you know, I think the element of being hard to play against with speed and maybe with a conscience is something that's developing again. And I think that, you know, when you see a team hoist the Stanley Cup, go back to the St. Louis Blues.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, big, a lot of heavy Western Canadian farm boys on the same page. You know, I'm not discriminating anyone in any part of the world. I mean, it's just that those guys were, there's a lot of Canadians on the same page there. And there was some grit to the way they played the game. And you're not talking necessarily dropping the gloves, because everybody now has the option not to drop the gloves. It's totally fine. And when I see rare events like where Foligno went after Corey Perry in the playoffs and Perry dropped the gloves, I was scratching my head. But then when I heard Foligno talk about the captain laying on the ice, that might be a dynamic that Mitch Marner and Matthews maybe never even knew existed. That's going way back in the archives of sure. old school, which, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. And I think Foligno is that kind of a throwback that, you know, it was something that I found it interesting. I talked to him about why he did it exactly. And he just felt new team, didn't like what the image of the player on the ice, and he went that far. I don't think we'll ever see that again, because that was a rare moment, kind of a pivotal moment in that regard of getting someone to fight. Corey Perry, Nick Foligno understood. I think Corey had to scratch his head and think, yeah, I guess this is how it used to be played. You know what I mean? You could see
he's played long enough, right?
Yeah.
He's played long enough in this league.
You could see the thought bubble above his head, like, I didn't mean to do it, but I understand why I have to. And that's hard to explain to an 8-year-old child that's trying to play hockey, or when you go to a school and talk to 10 or 12-year-olds, even adults now, you know, that dynamic. Because it's a strange dynamic. But I think the element of being that team that is just has a relentless ability, that defenseman that's always in your face, or a winger that's always finishing his checks, it gets old. And especially last year, where everyone had to face each other 8 to 10 times, you know, you get sick of people, you get sick of situations, you get sick of the way teams play. And, you know, there's teams that are easy to play against, and they know that, and there's teams that aren't. And I think that more teams than not are searching for that player that brings them that. I guess Tanev has an ability a little bit in Pittsburgh where they can get under the skin, shake the foundation a little bit, get the fans riled up, but also the guy in the locker room that just gives you a little bit more sense of bravado, if you will, when you're in that locker room and have that player.
Yeah, we'll get back to Brandon Tanev and his departure in a minute. But staying on this topic, Hawk, I wanted to ask you, you just mentioned about those, maybe those kind of the highly skilled teams that don't have that element. One team that we've seen taking a major about face in this offseason are the New York Rangers. Got Ryan Reeves. They went out and got one of the Tampa Bay players on their third line, Barkley Goodrow. You know, just gave up. I don't want to say gave up, but, you know, Buchnevich has moved on for Blaze from St. Louis. What do you think about their decision to kind of go that direction?
You know, it's an abrupt one. And you go back to Jeff Gorton and John Davidson and the reaction after that game. And you know, you're wondering if it was because, there was not that element there. And I guess the writing is on the wall that, you know, this is the reaction to being pushed around a little bit. I like it. I mean, I like the acquisition of Ryan Reeves. I think that's a bold statement. I think he is a guy in the league that's so well respected. And when you have a lot of young players who don't understand that, you know, they come from Europe or college and never seen that element, you know, it's not a great feeling a night before a game when you have that little bit of sense of, oh boy, you know, he's in the lineup, or what if, you know, what if I get the puck and he runs me over and look bad? You know, those things are real emotions and real feelings going into games. I like the, you know, when you look at that third line for Tampa with Barkley Goodrow being a key piece of it, and a guy who's worked his way into the National Hockey League and gets rewarded on Broadway. I love that. I mean, I think that's a great story. I think it's one of the best feel-good stories of the signings in the offseason. He goes to Tampa, wins two cups, and here he is now, a long way from San Jose, looking back, and he's in the middle of you know, the sports universe in New York. And I like they bring in that edge, that attitude. There's a certain way to play, and I still think, Tom, that players don't know how to act in the locker room, play after wins, after losses. We don't do. I mean, no one teaches you the degree of emotions and how to check them and how to act together as a team and how we're going to respond. You know, there's a team dynamic that has to kind of flow down the river with each other in that sense. And I think Shea Weber and Carey Price did that extremely well with Corey Perry in Montreal. And I think that was a big dynamic of bringing in young players like Caulfield and letting him see what it is to be around a group of adults. You know, you got to have the man in the room, if you will, the old man in the corner or whatever it is that you can look to, even out of the corner of your eye, to see how things are. And I think players like Goodrow, like Reeves, there's not only the attitude, but there's also the they can confirm that, you know, it's okay to smile after a loss if you've given it all and you worked hard and you know you're going to show up tomorrow and bring your attitude even more. It's just, I think it's a great thing, and I think that every team within it needs that conscience, and not to go out and run people and drop gloves and be completely. Listen, if you can get away with being the Broad Street Bullies right now, that'd be great. But I don't know how that dynamic would work, because I don't know how many teams would drop the gloves. But if you have players that are fast and can hit everything, I tell you what, that's a kind of a level where you can just, you can play that game and intimidate players through the body and through checking and that relentless pursuit.
Jody, going back to the Penguins, I mean, Ron Hextall, Brian Burke, they've spoken of the need to add size, snarl, truculence going forward, but so far really have just replaced Brandon Tanev with, you know, Brock McGinn. Do you think the Penguins need to add, you know, those qualities to make a deeper run in the playoffs moving forward?
You know what I do, and I think specifically of Crosby and Malkin, and, you know, I know Sid, he's a combative guy. You know, we've seen him fight from time to time. He's a good Nova Scotia boy, you know. He's going to stand up for himself and his teammates. I got to know him over the years, and I think there's a certain element within that team, especially with those guys who have been around. And when I think of Sidney Crosby coming into the league, you know, I think of Hal Gill, Billy Guerin, character guys that would do anything for their teammates, but also they guided him really well to start. I think that was a big part of Sid and his. He was mature beyond his years when he got to the league, but he grew up even faster as the man in the spotlight. And I think it's important for him. I think that that's a dynamic that he appreciates. He's a guy that seems to include absolutely everyone in anything that's happening at any time with this team and with anything he's involved with, a true leader. And I think to get a guy there to blossom, I think Brock McGinn's a nice pickup. I play with both of his brothers, both real tough kids. Jamie was one of them. Tough player I played with in San Jose. And, you know, there's just something about McGinn and his forecheck and how he plays the game. I like it, but I think they also need that other element. And I honestly think, Taylor, that teams are searching for those players. Teams are wondering who, like maybe they're asking guys like me, who are the guys in the league that you would not want to fight? You know what I mean? Because that element is, it's important. And I think especially when you have superstars who have been to the top of the mountain, know how to win. I think that especially in playoffs when the matchups are on, it's nice to have other players that are that can push back a little bit. And that's an important dynamic.
Goaltending's another big topic of discussion, you know, surrounding the Penguins. You've been in Columbus when Bobrovsky experienced some of, you know, his playoff struggles. The Penguins coming off a playoff loss where, you know, Jari's performance was not that great. The players and coaches, you know, they've talked about it, expressing confidence, saying all the right things. But as a former player, do you think there's any lingering doubt among Jari's teammates?
You know what? That's a really good question. I'm not close enough to that situation to really understand it. But from afar, you know, there was the question mark there with Jari in the end. I think it's too much to put on him. I think the defensive position is a big responsibility, not to the point of where the Islanders can make any goaltender look good, and so can Carolina. But I think there's a responsibility in front of him to help clean things up. I know there were some easy goals. Everyone analyzed and overanalyzed them in the playoffs. But I think he probably put too much pressure on himself. Was that a good learning experience? Yes. But what a good veteran goaltender that could help him relieve some pressure and maybe be a guy to talk to, help him? I think so. You know, I look at Jonathan Quick out in L.A., and I wonder if a guy like that sitting in a locker room with confidence, with Stanley Cup rings, if he could help and really guide a guy like Jari, who to me seems like, to me, just watching, he seemed like a man on an island a couple times trying to prove too much. And I would guess in that position, that would be a tough place to sit, because I think the goaltender position is the loneliest position in the world, especially for you and your friends and family who are watching and trying to, you know, jump through every save and every shot. So I think a little support system there might help him. He's got the skill set. You know, he looks like a great guy, good attitude person. So I might be too quick to tell on that.
Jody, on the Blue Jackets, there's been a number of very productive, high-profile players who were in Columbus but opted to not stay. You know, Panarin, Bobrovsky, most recently Seth Jones. But just a few days ago, you had Werenski sign a long-term deal, make a major commitment to the franchise. Do you think that can be kind of a turning point in keeping some of the big name, big time talents at home in the future?
Yeah, I really do think so. And I go back to, you know, we had Panarin, Bobrovsky, Duchene, Dzingel, and Panarin was the one player they wanted to keep. So let's not mistake that, you know, they did keep the free agents. They did put the run in because the time was right. The fan base needed it. The organization needed it. And they did some magical things. The next year they go in, and it's a situation where they scrap and claw and scratch their way and make the playoffs with all the injuries and call-ups. There's no one added at the deadline. They go into the bubble. I think they added one piece. There was a fourth-line centerman. Anyways, I'll think of his name. And they go into the bubble, and, you know, they beat Toronto in the play-ins. Then they take Tampa to five-period overtime game, and they lose. And the relief on Tampa to get by Columbus in that first game and then to get by them in the series, you could sense that it was a worry for them. And that's – listen, it's not Columbus, Ohio, and I know it's not a destination on a map, but the players that come here, if you can continue the trajectory in the right way, and that's that upward play, you're going to keep players here. But to answer your question, Zach Werenski is a no-nonsense guy. His last contract, the offer was there. He understood what he was worth. He signed it. Here, the Blue Jackets might have overpaid for the first part of this, but he wants to be the man. He understands the excitement of this city. He's 3 hours from home. He knows what he's a part of. And for him to sign it like this, it puts the team in motion to get back on the right plane. And I think that's the key to this whole thing, Dave. Having players like that stay, put results in and prove yourself on the ice, which they're going to have to do again. And then from there, that's where you get players to say, hey, you know what? They got it together in Columbus. I want to be a part of it. Pittsburgh's done that. Listen, Pittsburgh's not a destination city either, but they win. And they keep pushing to win, because they know the value of the big pieces, and that's why players want to go there and play with Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin.
It's long been a given in this game, Jody, that some of the most rugged, toughest guys on the ice are some of the nicest guys off the ice. It also turns out, though, that some of those toughest guys make some of the best analysts. So why is that? And this is something that you're certainly equipped to address.
Yeah, it's us and the goalies. And I joke with Boucher, and who's doing a heck of a job for now ESPN. You know what? I think there's different levels to the game. And I think as a fourth-line winger, our leash was extremely short. So what I mean is, you know, So for me, the dynamic of fighting was one dynamic. That was always on one section of my brain. Then the dynamic of actually getting the puck and making the right play offensively was there. Natural ability, really, Dave. That's one I tucked away a little bit. I bring it out once in a while now when I'm playing like men's league hockey or something like that. But the other dynamic is the team concepts. And if you're the first man on the forecheck, if you're the last man on the back check, if you do get switched in the defensive zone, what's the responsibilities of the center iceman? When you get the puck on the wall as a winger, where's your options? What are your other teammates expecting you to do with it? The responsibility of playing the game. And I think we had to be thorough in practice. We had to be thorough in meetings. And maybe I'm overthinking it with a very educational answer, but this is my belief. I really believe this. And, you know, Boucher was a backup goalie. He saw the game from far away. He understood plays on how they unfold as a goalie. But I think for us who watched and had to be in tune with every second and every practice, every meeting, and every moment of the game, I think that benefited us for as far as being away from the game and understanding it. Plus, I've been around hockey for 40 years. So now, you know, it's been 20 years in the National Hockey League, or 21 now, which is, I'm very proud to say that. But I think those details inside the ropes and understanding and have the appreciation and taking care of the details has helped us to be, I think Louis DeBrusque would say the same thing. He's doing a heck of a job out there in Western Canada. We spent a lot of time watching and making sure we did the right thing.
Good stuff, Joey. Thank you very much. And as always, it's a pleasure talking to you. That's it for this edition of the 66 to 87 podcast. For Jody Shelley, for Dave Molinari and Taylor Haas, this is Tom Reed. We'll talk to you later in the week.